by secret ballot, and their decrees were promulgated in the venerable name of the Roman Senate and people. It would not be easy to assign a period in which this theory of government has been reduced to accurate and constant practice, since the establishment of order has been gradually connected with the decay of liberty. But in the year 1580, the ancient statutes were collected, methodized in three books, and adapted to present use, under the pontificate and with the approbation of Gregory the 13th. This civil and criminal code is the modern law of the city, and if the popular assemblies have been abolished, a foreign senator, with the three conservators, still resides in the palace of the capital. The policy of the Caesars has been repeated by the popes, and the Bishop of Rome affected to maintain the form of a republic while he reigned with the absolute powers of a temporal as well as spiritual monarch. It is an obvious truth that the times must be suited to extraordinary characters, and that the genius of Cromwell or Retz might now expire in obscurity. The political enthusiasm of Rienzi had exalted him to a throne. The same enthusiasm in the next century conducted his imitator to the gallows. The birth of Stephen Porcaro was noble, his reputation spotless. His tongue was armed with eloquence, his mind was enlightened with learning, and he aspired beyond the aim of vulgar ambition to free his country and immortalize his name. The dominion of priests is most odious to a liberal spirit. Every scruple was removed by the recent knowledge of the fable and forgery of Constantine's donation. Petrarch was now the oracle of the Italians, and as often as Porcaro revolved the ode which describes the patriot and hero of Rome, he applied to himself the visions of the prophetic bard. His first trial of the popular feelings was at the funeral of Eugenius IV. In an elaborate speech, he called the Romans to liberty and arms, and they listened with apparent pleasure, till Porcaro was interrupted and answered by a grave advocate who pleaded for the church and state. By every law, the seditious orator was guilty of treason, but the benevolence of the new pontiff, who viewed his character with pity and esteem, attempted by an honorable office to convert the patriot into a friend. The inflexible Roman returned from Anagni with an increase of reputation and zeal, and on the first opportunity, the games of the Place Navona, he tried to inflame the casual dispute of some boys and mechanics into a general rising of the people. Yet the humane Nicholas was still averse to accept the forfeit of his life, and the traitor was removed from the scene of temptation to Bologna, with a liberal allowance for his support, and the easy obligation of presenting himself each day before the governor of the city. But Porcaro had learned from the younger Brutus that with tyrants no faith or gratitude should be observed. The exile declaimed against the arbitrary sentence. A party and a conspiracy was gradually formed. His nephew, a daring youth, assembled a band of volunteers, and on the appointed evening a feast was prepared at his house for the friends of the Republic. Their leader, who had escaped from Bologna, appeared among them in a robe of purple and gold. His voice, his countenance, his gestures bespoke the man who had devoted his life or death to the glorious cause. In a studied oration, he expatiated on the motives and the means of their enterprise. The name and liberties of Rome, the sloth and pride of their ecclesiastical tyrants, the active or passive consent of their fellow citizens, 300 soldiers and 400 exiles long exercised in arms or in wrongs, the license of revenge to edge their swords and 1,000,000 of ducats to reward their victory. It would be easy, he said, on the next day, the festival of the Epiphany, to seize the Pope and his cardinals before the doors are at the altar of St. Peter's, to lead them in chains under the walls of St. Angelo, to extort, by the threat of their instant death, a surrender of the castle, to ascend the vacant capital, to ring the alarm bell, and to restore in a popular assembly the ancient Republic of Rome. While he triumphed, he was already betrayed. The senator, with a strong guard, invested the house. The nephew of Porcaro cut his way through the crowd. But the unfortunate Stephen was drawn from a chest, lamenting that his enemies had anticipated by 3 hours the execution of his design. After such manifest and repeated guilt, even the mercy of Nicholas was silent. Porcaro and 9 of his accomplices were hanged without the benefit of the sacraments, and amidst the fears and invectives of the papal court, the Romans pitied and almost applauded these martyrs of their country. But their applause was mute, their pity ineffectual, their liberty forever extinct. And if they have since risen in a vacancy of the throne or a scarcity of bread, such accidental tumults may be found in the bosom of the most abject servitude. But the independence of the nobles, which was fomented by discord, survived the freedom of the commons, which must be founded in union. A privilege of rapine and oppression was long maintained by the barons of Rome. Their houses were a fortress and a sanctuary, and the ferocious train of banditti and criminals whom they protected from the law repaid the hospitality with the service of their swords and daggers. The private interest of the pontiffs, or their nephews, sometimes involved them in these domestic feuds. Under the reign of Sixtus IV, Rome was distracted by the battles and sieges of the rival houses. After the conflagration of his palace, the protonotary Colonna was tortured and beheaded. And Savelli, his captive friend, was murdered on the spot for refusing to join in the acclamations of the victorious Ursini. But the popes no longer trembled in the Vatican. They had strength to command, if they had resolution to claim, the obedience of their subjects. And the strangers who observed these partial disorders admired the easy taxes and wise administration of the ecclesiastical state. The spiritual funders of the Vatican depend on the force of opinion, and if that opinion be supplanted by reason or passion, the sound may idly waste itself in the air, and the helpless priest is exposed to the brutal violence of a noble or a plebeian adversary. But after their return from Avignon, the keys of St. Peter were guarded by the sword of St. Paul. Rome was commanded by an impregnable citadel. The use of cannon is a powerful engine against popular seditions. A regular force of cavalry and infantry was enlisted under the banners of the Pope. His ample revenue supplied the resources of war. And, from the extent of his domain, he could bring down on a rebellious city an army of hostile neighbors and loyal subjects. Since the union of the duchies of Ferrara and Urbino, the ecclesiastical state extends from the Mediterranean to the Adriatic, and from the confines of Naples to the banks of the Po. And as early as the 16th century, the greater part of that spacious and fruitful country acknowledged the lawful claims and temporal sovereignty of the Roman pontiffs. Their claims were readily deduced from the genuine or fabulous donations of the darker ages. The successive steps of their final settlement would engage us too far in the transactions of Italy and even of Europe. The crimes of Alexander VI, the martial operations of Julius II, and the liberal policy of Leo X, a theme which has been adorned by the pens of the noblest historians of the times. In the first period of their conquests, till the expedition of Charles VIII, the popes might successfully wrestle with the adjacent princes and states, whose military force was equal or inferior to their own. But as soon as the monarchs of France, Germany, and Spain contended with gigantic arms for the dominion of Italy, they supplied with art the deficiency of strength, and concealed in a labyrinth of wars and treaties their aspiring views and the immortal hope of chasing the barbarians beyond the Alps. The nice balance of the Vatican was often subverted by the soldiers of the North and West, who were united under the standard of Charles V. The feeble and fluctuating policy of Clement VII exposed his person and dominions to the conqueror. Then Rome was abandoned 7 months to a lawless army, more cruel and rapacious than the Goths and Vandals. After this severe lesson, the popes contracted their ambition, which was almost satisfied, resumed the character of a common parent, and abstained from all offensive hostilities except in a hasty quarrel when the Vicar of Christ and the Turkish Sultan were armed at the same time against the Kingdom of Naples. The French and Germans at length withdrew from the field of battle. Milan, Naples, Sicily, Sardinia, and the seacoast of Tuscany were firmly possessed by the Spaniards, and it became their interest to maintain the peace and independence of Italy, which continued almost without disturbance from the middle of the 16th to the opening of the 18th century. The Vatican was swayed and protected by the religious policy of the Catholic king. His prejudice and interest disposed him in every dispute to support the prince against the people, and instead of the encouragement, the aid, and the asylum which they obtained from the adjacent states, the friends of liberty or the enemies of law were enclosed on all sides within the iron circle of despotism. The long habits of obedience and education subdued the turbulent spirit of the nobles and commons of Rome. The barons forgot the arms and factions of their ancestors, and insensibly became the servants of luxury and government. Instead of maintaining a crowd of tenants and followers, the produce of their estates was consumed in the private expenses which multiply the pleasures and diminish the power of the lord. The Colonna and Orsini vied with each other in the decoration of their palaces and chapels, and their antique splendor was rivaled or surpassed by the sudden opulence of the papal families. In Rome, the voice of freedom and discord is no longer heard, and instead of the foaming torrent, a smooth and stagnant lake reflects the image of idleness and servitude. A Christian, a philosopher, and a patriot will be equally scandalized by the temporal kingdom of the clergy. And the local majesty of Rome, the remembrance of her consuls and triumphs, may seem to embitter the sense and aggravate the shame of her slavery. If we calmly weigh the merits and defects of the ecclesiastical government, it may be praised in its present state as a mild, decent, and tranquil system, exempt from the dangers of a minority, the sallies of youth, the expenses of luxury, and the calamities of war. But these advantages are overbalanced by a frequent, perhaps a septennial, election of a sovereign who is seldom a native of the country. The reign of a young statesman of 80, in the decline of his life and abilities, without hope to accomplish and without children to inherit the labors of his transitory reign. The successful candidate is drawn from the church and even the convent, from the mode of education and life the most adverse to reason, humanity, and freedom. In the trammels of servile faith he has learned to believe because it is absurd to revere all that is contemptible and to despise whatever might deserve the esteem of a rational being, to punish error as a crime, to reward mortification and celibacy as the first of virtues, to place the saints of the calendar above the heroes of Rome and the sages of Athens, and to consider the missal or the crucifix as more useful instruments than the plough or the loom. In the office of nuncio, or the rank of cardinal, he may acquire some knowledge of the world, but the primitive stain will adhere to his mind and manners. From study and experience, he may suspect the mystery of his profession. But the sacerdotal artist will imbibe some portion of the bigotry which he inculcates. The genius of Sixtus V burst from the gloom of a Franciscan cloister. In a reign of 5 years, he exterminated the outlaws and banditti, abolished the profane sanctuaries of Rome, formed a naval and military force, restored and emulated the monuments of antiquity, and after a liberal use and large increase of the revenue, left 5 millions of crowns in the castle of St. Angelo. But his justice was sullied with cruelty. His activity was prompted by the ambition of conquest. After his decease, the abuses revived. The treasure was dissipated. He entailed on posterity 35 new taxes and the venality of offices, and after his death, his statue was demolished by an ungrateful or an injured people. The wild and original character of Sixtus V stands alone in the series of the pontiffs. The maxims and effects of their temporal government may be collected from the positive and comparative view of the arts and philosophy, the agriculture and trade, the wealth and population of the ecclesiastical state. For myself, it is my wish to depart in charity with all mankind, nor am I willing in these last moments to offend even the Pope and clergy of Rome. Chapter 71. Prospect of the ruins of Rome in the 15th century. Four causes of the decay and destruction. Example of the Colosseum. Renovation of the city. Conclusion of the whole work. In the last days of Pope Eugenius IV, two of his servants, the learned Pogius and a friend, ascended the Capitoline Hill, reposed themselves among the ruins of columns and temples, and viewed from that commanding spot the wide and various prospect of desolation. The place and the object gave ample scope for moralizing on the vicissitudes of fortune, which spares neither man nor the proudest of his works, which buries empires and cities in a common grave, and it was agreed that, in proportion to her former greatness, the fall of Rome was the more awful and deplorable. Her primeval state, such as she might appear in a remote age when Evander entertained the stranger of Troy, has been delineated by the fancy of Virgil. This Tarpeian rock was then a savage and solitary thicket. In the time of the poet, it was crowned with the golden roofs of a temple. The temple is overthrown. The gold has been pillaged, the wheel of fortune has accomplished her revolution, and the sacred ground is again disfigured with thorns and brambles. The hill of the Capitol on which we sit was formerly the head of the Roman Empire, the citadel of the earth, the terror of kings, illustrated by the footsteps of so many triumphs, enriched with the spoils and tributes of so many nations. This spectacle of the world, how is it fallen? How changed? How defaced! The path of victory is obliterated by vines, and the benches of the senators are concealed by a dunghill. Cast your eyes on the Palatine Hill, and seek among the shapeless and enormous fragments the marble theatre, the obelisks, the colossal statues, the porticos of Nero's palace. Survey the other hills of the city. The vacant space is interrupted only by ruins and gardens. The forum of the Roman people, where they assembled to enact their laws and elect their magistrates, is now enclosed for the cultivation of potherbs, or thrown open for the reception of swine and buffaloes. the public and private edifices that were founded for eternity lie prostrate, naked, and broken, like the limbs of a mighty giant. And the ruin is the more visible from these stupendous relics that have survived the injuries of time and fortune. These relics are minutely described by Poggius, one of the first who raised his eyes from the monuments of legendary to those of classic superstition. Besides a bridge, an arch, a sepulchre, and the pyramid of Cestius, he could discern, of the age of the Republic, a double row of vaults in the salt office of the capital, which were inscribed with the name and munificence of Catullus. 11 temples were visible in some degree from the perfect form of the Pantheon to the 3 arches and a marble column of the Temple of Peace, which Vespasian erected after the civil wars and the Jewish triumph. Of the number, which he rashly defines, of 7 thermi, or public baths, none were sufficiently entire to represent the use and distribution of the several parts. But those of Diocletian and Antoninus Caracalla still retained the titles of the founders, and astonished the curious spectator who, in observing their solidity and extent, the variety of marbles, the size and multitude of the columns, compared the labor and expense with the use and importance. Of the baths of Constantine, of Alexander, of Domitian, or rather of Titus, some vestige might yet be found. The triumphal arches of Titus, Severus, and Constantine were entire, both the structure and the inscriptions. A falling fragment was honored with the name of Trajan, and 2 arches, then extant in the Flaminian way, have been ascribed to the base memory of Faustina and Gallienus. After the wonder of the Colosseum, Poggius might have overlooked a small amphitheatre of brick, most probably for the use of the Praetorian camp. The theatres of Marcellus and Pompey were occupied in a great measure by public and private buildings, and in the circus, Agonalis and Maximus, little more than the situation and the form could be investigated. The columns of Trajan and Antonine were still erect, but the Egyptian obelisks were broken or buried. A people of gods and heroes, the workmanship of art was reduced to 1 equestrian figure of gilt brass and to 5 marble statues, of which the most conspicuous were the 2 horses of Phidias and Praxiteles. The 2 mausoleums or sepulchres of Augustus and Hadrian could not totally be lost, but the former was only visible as a mound of earth, and the latter, the castle of St. Angelo, had acquired the name and appearance of a modern fortress. With the addition of some separate and nameless columns, such were the remains of the ancient city, for the marks of a more recent structure might be detected in the walls, which formed a circumference of 10 miles, included 379 turrets, and opened into the country by 13 gates. This melancholy picture was drawn above 900 years after the fall of the Western Empire, and even of the Gothic Kingdom of Italy. A long period of distress and anarchy in which empire and arts and riches had migrated from the banks of the Tiber was incapable of restoring or adorning the city. And as all that is human must retrograde if it do not advance, every successive age must have hastened the ruin of the works of antiquity. To measure the progress of decay and to ascertain at each era the state of each edifice would be an endless and a useless labor, and I shall content myself with 2 observations which will introduce a short inquiry into the general causes and effects. 1. 200 years before the eloquent complaint of Poggius, an anonymous writer composed a description of Rome. His ignorance may repeat the same objects under strange and fabulous names. Yet this barbarous topographer had eyes and ears. He could observe the visible remains. He could listen to the tradition of the people. And he distinctly enumerates 7 theatres, 11 baths, 12 arches, and 18 palaces, of which many had disappeared before the time of Poggius. It is apparent that many stately monuments of antiquity survived till a late period, and that the principles of destruction acted with vigorous and increasing energy in the 13th and 14th centuries. 2. The same reflection must be applied to the three last ages, and we should vainly seek the Septizonium of Severus, which is celebrated by Petrarch and the antiquarians of the 16th century. While the Roman edifices were still entire, the first blows, however weighty and impetuous, were resisted by the solidity of the mass and the harmony of the parts. But the slightest touch would precipitate the fragments of arches and columns that already nodded to their fall. After a diligent inquiry, I can discern four principal causes of the ruin of Rome, which continue to operate in a period of more than 1,000 years. 1. The injuries of time and nature. 2. The hostile attacks of the barbarians and Christians. 3. The use and abuse of the materials. And 4. The domestic quarrels of the Romans. 1. The art of man is able to construct monuments far more permanent than the narrow space of his own existence. Yet these monuments, like himself, are perishable and frail, and in the boundless annals of time, his life and his labors must equally be measured as a fleeting moment. Of a simple and solid edifice, it is not easy, however, to circumscribe the duration. As the wonders of ancient days, the pyramids attracted the curiosity of the ancients. 100 generations, the leaves of autumn have dropped into the grave, and after the fall of the pharaohs and Ptolemies, the Caesars and caliphs, the same pyramids stand erect and unshaken above the floods of the Nile. A complex figure of various and minute parts is more accessible to injury and decay, and the silent lapse of time is often accelerated by hurricanes and earthquakes, by fires and inundations. The air and earth have doubtless been shaken, and the lofty turrets of Rome have tottered from their foundations. But the seven hills do not appear to be placed on the great cavities of the globe, nor has the city in any age been exposed to the convulsions of nature, which in the climate of Antioch, Lisbon, or Lima have crumbled in a few moments the works of ages into dust. Fire is the most powerful agent of life and death. The rapid mischief may be kindled and propagated by the industry or negligence of mankind, and every period of the Roman annals is marked by the repetition of similar calamities. A memorable conflagration, the guilt or misfortune of Nero's reign, continued, though with unequal fury, either 6 or 9 days. Innumerable buildings, crowded in close and crooked streets, supplied perpetual fuel for the flames. And when they ceased, 4 only of the 14 regions were left entire. 3 were totally destroyed, and 7 were deformed by the relics of smoking and lacerated edifices. In the full meridian of empire, the metropolis arose with fresh beauty from her ashes. Yet the memory of the old deplored their irreparable losses. The arts of Greece, the trophies of victory, the monuments of primitive or fabulous antiquity. In the days of distress and anarchy, every wound is mortal, every fall irretrievable. Nor can the damage be restored either by the public care of government or the activity of private interest. Yet 2 causes may be alleged which render the calamity of fire more destructive to a flourishing than a decayed city. The more combustible materials of brick, timber, and metals are first melted or consumed, but the flames may play without injury or effect on the naked walls and massy arches that have been despoiled of their ornaments. It is among the common and plebeian habitations that a mischievous spark is most easily blown to a conflagration, but as soon as they are devoured, the greater edifices which have resisted or escaped are left as so many islands in a state of solitude and safety. From her situation, Rome is exposed to the danger of frequent inundations. Without excepting the Tiber, the rivers that descend from either side of the Apennine have a short and irregular course, a shallow stream in the summer heats, an impetuous torrent when it is swelled in the spring or winter by the fall of rain and the melting of the snows. When the current is repelled from the sea by adverse winds, when the ordinary bed is inadequate to the weight of waters, they rise above the banks and overspread, without limits or control, the plains and cities of the adjacent country. Soon after the triumph of the First Punic War, the Tiber was increased by unusual rains, and the inundation surpassing all former measure of time and place destroyed all the buildings that were situated below the hills of Rome. According to the variety of ground, the same mischief was produced by different means, and the edifices were either swept away by the sudden impulse, or dissolved and undermined by the long continuance of the flood. Under the reign of Augustus, the same calamity was renewed. The lawless river overturned the palaces and temples on its banks, and after the labors of the emperor in cleansing and widening the bed that was encumbered with ruins, the vigilance of his successors was exercised by similar dangers and designs. The project of diverting into new channels the Tiber itself or some of the dependent streams was long opposed by superstition and local interests, nor did the use compensate the toil and cost of the tardy and imperfect execution. The servitude of rivers is the noblest and most important victory which man has obtained over the licentiousness of nature, and if such were the ravages of the Tiber under a firm and active government, what could oppose, or who can enumerate the injuries of the city after the fall of the Western Empire? A remedy was at length produced by the evil itself. The accumulation of rubbish and the earth that is being washed down from the hills is supposed to have elevated the plain of Rome 14 or 15 feet, perhaps, above the ancient level, and the modern city is less accessible to the attacks of the river. 2. The crowd of writers of every nation, who impute the destruction of the Roman monuments to the Goths and the Christians, have neglected to inquire how far they were animated by a hostile principle, and how far they possessed the means and the leisure to satiate their enmity. In the preceding volumes of this history, I have described the triumph of barbarism and religion, and I can only resume, in a few words, their real or imaginary connection with the ruin of ancient Rome. Our fancy may create or adopt a pleasing romance that the Goths and Vandals sallied from Scandinavia, ardent to avenge the flight of Odin, to break the chains and to chastise the oppressors of mankind, that they wish to burn the records of classic literature and to found their national architecture on the broken members of the Tuscan and Corinthian orders. But in simple truth, the northern conquerors were neither sufficiently savage nor sufficiently refined to entertain such aspiring ideas of destruction and revenge. The shepherds of Scythia and Germany had been educated in the armies of the empire, whose discipline they acquired, and whose weakness they invaded. With the familiar use of the Latin tongue, they had learned to reverence the name and titles of Rome, and though incapable of emulating, they were more inclined to admire than to abolish the arts and studies of a brighter period. In the transient possession of a rich and unresisting capital, the soldiers of Alaric and Genseric were stimulated by the passions of a victorious army. Amidst the wanton indulgence of lust or cruelty, portable wealth was the object of their search. Nor could they derive either pride or pleasure from the unprofitable reflection that they had battered to the ground the works of the consuls and Caesars. Their moments were indeed precious. The Goths evacuated Rome on the 6th, the Vandals on the 15th day, and though it be far more difficult to build than to destroy, their hasty assault would have made a slight impression on the solid piles of antiquity. We may remember that both Alaric and Genseric affected to spare the buildings of the city, that they subsisted in strength and beauty under the auspicious government of Theodoric, and that the momentary resentment of Totila was disarmed by his own temper and the advice of his friends and enemies. From these innocent barbarians the reproach may be transferred to the Catholics of Rome. The statues, altars, and houses of the demons were an abomination in their eyes, and in the absolute command of the city they might labor with zeal and perseverance to erase the idolatry of their ancestors. The demolition of the temples in the East affords to them an example of conduct and to us an argument of belief, and it is probable that a portion of guilt or merit may be imputed with justice to the Roman proselytes. Yet their abhorrence was confined to the monuments of heathen superstition, and the civil structures that were dedicated to the business or pleasure of society might be preserved without injury or scandal. The change of religion was accomplished not by a popular tumult, but by the decrees of the emperors, of the Senate, and of time. Of the Christian hierarchy, the bishops of Rome were commonly the most prudent and least fanatic, nor can any positive charge be opposed to the meritorious act of saving and converting the majestic structure of the Pantheon. 3. The value of any object that supplies the wants or pleasures of mankind is compounded of its substance and its form, of the materials and the manufacture. Its price must depend on the number of persons by whom it may be acquired and used, on the extent of the market, and consequently on the ease or difficulty of remote exportation, according to the nature of the commonality, its local situation, and the temporary circumstances of the world. The barbarian conquerors of Rome usurped in a moment the toil and treasure of successive ages. But except the luxuries of immediate consumption, they must view without desire all that could not be removed from the city in the Gothic wagons or the fleet of the Vandals. Gold and silver were the first objects of their avarice. As in every country and in the smallest compass, they represent the most ample command of the industry and possessions of mankind. A vase or a statue of those precious metals might tempt the vanity of some barbarian chief, but the grosser multitude, regardless of the form, was tenacious only of the substance, and the melted ingots might be readily divided and stamped into the current coin of the empire. The less active or less fortunate robbers were reduced to the baser plunder of brass, lead, iron, and copper. Whatever had escaped the gods and Vandals was pillaged by the Greek tyrants, and the Emperor Constans, in his rapacious visit, stripped the bronze tiles from the roof of the Pantheon. The edifices of Rome might be considered as a vast and various mine. The first labor of extracting the materials was already performed. The metals were purified and cast. The marbles were hewn and polished. And after foreign and domestic rapine had been satiated, the remains of the city, could a purchaser have been found, were still venal. The monuments of antiquity had been left naked of their precious ornaments, but the Romans would demolish with their own hands the arches and walls if the hope of profit could surpass the cost of the labor and exportation. If Charlemagne had fixed in Italy the seat of the Western Empire, his genius would have aspired to restore rather than to violate the works of the Caesars. But policy confined the French monarch to the forests of Germany. His taste could be gratified only by destruction. And the new palace of Aix-la-Chapelle was decorated with the marbles of Ravenna and Rome. 500 years after Charlemagne, a king of Sicily, Robert, the wisest and most liberal sovereign of the age, was supplied with the same materials by the easy navigation of the Tiber and the sea. And Petrarch sighs an indignant complaint that the ancient capital of the world should adorn from her own bowels the slothful luxury of Naples. But these examples of plunder or purchase were rare in the darker ages, and the Romans, alone and unenvied, might have applied to their private or public use the remaining structures of antiquity if, in their present form and situation, they had not been useless in a great measure to the city and its inhabitants. The walls still described the old circumference, but the city had descended from the seven hills into the Campus Martius, and some of the noblest monuments which had braved the injuries of time were left in a desert far remote from the habitations of mankind. The palaces of the senators were no longer adapted to the manners and fortunes of their indigent successors. The use of baths and porticos was forgotten. In the 6th century, the games of the theatre, amphitheatre, and circus had been interrupted. Some temples were devoted to the prevailing worship, but the Christian churches preferred the holy figure of the cross, and fashion or reason had distributed after a peculiar model the cells and offices of the cloister. Under the ecclesiastical reign, the number of these pious foundations was enormously multiplied, and the city was crowded with 40 monasteries of men, 20 of women, and 60 chapters and colleges of canons and priests, who aggravated instead of relieving the depopulations of the 10th century. But if the forms of ancient architecture were disregarded by a people insensible of their use and beauty, the plentiful materials were applied to every call of necessity or superstition, till the fairest columns of the Ionic and Corinthian orders, the richest marbles of Paros and Numidia, were degraded, perhaps to the support of a convent or a stable. The daily havoc which is perpetrated by the Turks in the cities of Greece and Asia may afford a melancholy example, and in the gradual destruction of the monuments of Rome, Sixtus V may alone be excused for employing the stones of the Septizonium in the glorious edifice of St. Peter's. A fragment, a ruin, howsoever mangled or profaned, may be viewed with pleasure and regret, but the greater part of the marble was deprived of substance, as well as of place and proportion. It was burnt to lime for the purpose of cement. Since the arrival of Pogius, the Temple of Concord and many capital structures had vanished from his eyes, and an epigram of the same age expresses a just and pious fear that the continuance of this practice would finally annihilate all the monuments of antiquity. The smallness of their numbers was the sole check on the demands and depredations of the Romans. The imagination of Petrarch might create the presence of a mighty people, and I hesitate to believe that even in the 14th century they could be reduced to a contemptible list of 33,000 inhabitants. From that period to the reign of Leo X, if they multiplied the amount of 85,000, the increase of citizens was in some degree pernicious to the ancient city. 4. I have reserved for the last the most potent and forcible cause of destruction, the domestic hostilities of the Romans themselves. Under the dominion of the Greek and French emperors, the peace of the city was disturbed by accidental, though frequent, seditions. It is from the decline of the latter, from the beginning of the 10th century, that we may date the licentiousness of private war, which violated with impunity the laws of the Code and the Gospel, without respecting the majesty of the absent sovereign or the presence and person of the Vicar of Christ. In a dark period of 500 years, Rome was perpetually afflicted by the sanguinary quarrels of the nobles and the people, the Guelphs and Ghibellines, the Colonna and Orsini, and if much has escaped the knowledge, and much is unworthy of the notice of history, I have exposed in the two preceding chapters the causes and effects of the public disorders. At such a time, when every quarrel was decided by the sword, and none could trust their lives or properties to the impotence of law, the powerful citizens were armed for safety or offence against the domestic enemies whom they feared or hated. Except Venice alone, the same dangers and designs were common to all the free republics of Italy, and the nobles usurped the prerogative of fortifying their houses and erecting strong towers that were capable of resisting a sudden attack. The cities were filled with these hostile edifices, and the example of Lucca, which contained 300 towers, her law, which combined their height to the measure of 80 feet, may be extended with suitable latitude to the more opulent and populous states. The first step of the senator Brancaleone in the establishment of peace and justice was to demolish, as we have already seen, 140 of the towers of Rome, and in the last days of anarchy and discord, as late as the reign of Martin V, 44 still stood in one of the 13 or 14 regions of the city. To this mischievous purpose, the remains of antiquity were most readily adapted. The temples and arches afforded a broad and solid base for the new structures of brick and stone, and we can name the modern turrets that were raised on the triumphal monuments of Julius Caesar, Titus, and the Antonines. With some slight alterations, a theatre, an amphitheatre, a mausoleum was transformed into a strong and spacious citadel. I need not repeat that the mole of Hadrian has assumed the title and form of the castle of St. Angelo. The septizonium of Severus was capable of standing against a royal army. The sepulchre of Metella has sunk under its outworks. The theatres of Pompey and Marcellus were occupied by the Savelli and Ursini families. And the rough fortress has been gradually softened to the splendour and elegance of an Italian palace. Even the churches were encompassed with arms and bulwarks, and the military engines on the roof of St. Peter's were the terror of the Vatican and the scandal of the Christian world. Whatever is fortified will be attacked, and whatever is attacked may be destroyed. Could the Romans have wrested from the popes the castle of St. Angelo, they had resolved by public decree to annihilate that monument of servitude. Every building of defense was exposed to a siege, and in every siege the arts and engines of destruction were laboriously employed. After the death of Nicholas IV, Rome, without a sovereign or a senate, was abandoned 6 months to the fury of civil war. The houses, says a cardinal and poet of the times, were crushed by the weight and velocity of enormous stones. The walls were perforated by the strokes of a battering ram. The towers were involved in fire and smoke, and the assailants were stimulated by rapine and revenge. The work was consummated by the tyranny of the laws, and the factions of Italy alternately exercised a blind and thoughtless vengeance on their adversaries, whose houses and castles they razed to the ground. In comparing the days of foreign with the ages of domestic hostility, we must pronounce that the latter have been far more ruinous to the city, and our opinion is confirmed by the evidence of Petrarch. "Behold," says the laureate, "the relics of Rome, the image of her pristine greatness. Neither time nor the barbarian can boast the merit of this stupendous destruction. It was perpetrated by her own citizens, by the most illustrious of her sons. And your ancestors," he writes to a noble, Annibaldi, "have done with the battering ram what the Punic hero could not accomplish with the sword." The influence of the two last principles of decay must in some degree be multiplied by each other, since the houses and towers which were subverted by civil war required a new and perpetual supply from the monuments of antiquity. These general observations may be separately applied to the amphitheatre of Titus, which has obtained the name of the Colosseum, either from its magnitude or from Nero's colossal statue. An edifice, had it been left to time and nature, which might perhaps have claimed an eternal duration. The curious antiquaries, who have computed the numbers and seats, are disposed to believe that above the upper row of stone steps the amphitheatre was encircled and elevated with several stages of wooden galleries, which were repeatedly consumed by fire and restored by the emperors. Whatever was precious or portable or profane, the statues of gods and heroes, and the costly ornaments of sculpture which were cast in brass or overspread with leaves of gold and silver, became the first prey of conquest or fanaticism, of the avarice of the barbarians or the Christians. In the massy stones of the Colosseum, many holes are discerned, and the two most probable conjectures represent the various accidents of its decay. These stones were connected by solid links of brass or iron, nor had the eye of rapine overlooked the value of the baser metals. The vacant space was converted into a fair or market. The artisans of the Colosseum are mentioned in an ancient survey, and the chasms were perforated or enlarged to receive the poles that supported the shops or tents of the mechanic trades. Reduced to its naked majesty, the Flavian amphitheatre was contemplated with awe and admiration by the pilgrims of the north, and their rude enthusiasm broke forth in a sublime proverbial expression which is recorded in the 8th century in the fragments of the Venerable Bede. As long as the Colosseum stands, Rome shall stand. When the Colosseum falls, Rome will fall. When Rome falls, the world will fall. Then the modern system of war, a situation commanded by three hills, would not be chosen for a fortress. But the strength of the walls and arches could resist the engines of assault. A numerous garrison might be lodged in the enclosure, and while one faction occupied the Vatican and the Capitol, the other was entrenched in the Lateran and the Colosseum. The abolition at Rome of the ancient games must be understood with some latitude, and the carnival sports of the Testacean Mount and the Circus Argonalis were regulated by the law or custom of the city. The senator presided with dignity and pomp to adjudge and distribute the prizes, the gold ring, or the pallium, as it was styled, of cloth or silk. A tribute on the Jews supplied the annual expense, and the races, on foot, on horseback, or in chariots, were ennobled by a tilt and tournament of 72 of the Roman youth. In the year 1332, a bull feast, after the fashion of the Moors and Spaniards, was celebrated in the Colosseum itself, and the living manners are painted in a diary of the times. A convenient order of benches was restored, and a general proclamation, as far as Rimini and Ravenna, invited the nobles to exercise their skill and courage in this perilous adventure. The Roman ladies were marshalled in three squadrons and seated in three balconies, which on this day, the 3rd of September, were lined with scarlet cloth. The fair Jacova di Rovere led the matrons from beyond the Tiber, a pure and native race who still represent the features and character of antiquity. The remainder of the city was divided as usual between the Colonna and Ursini. The two factions were proud of the number and beauty of their female bands. The charms of Sabella Ursini are mentioned with praise, and the Colonna regretted the absence of the youngest of their house, who had sprained her ankle in the garden of Nero's tower. The lots of the champions were drawn by an old and respectable citizen, and they descended into the arena, or pit, to encounter the wild bulls, on foot, as it should seem, with a single spear. Amidst the crowd, our analyst has selected the names, colors, and devices of 20 of the most conspicuous knights. Several of the names are the most illustrious of Rome and the ecclesiastical state: Malatesta, Polenta, Della Valle, Caffarello, Savelli, Capoccio, Conti, Annibaldi, Altieri, Corsi. The colors were adapted to their taste and situation. The devices are expressive of hope or despair, and breathe the spirit of gallantry and arms. I am alone, like the youngest of the Horatii, the confidence of an intrepid stranger. I live disconsolate, a weeping widower. I burn under the ashes, a discreet lover. I adore Lavinia or Lucretia, the ambiguous declaration of a modern passion. My faith is as pure, the motto of a white livery. Who is stronger than myself? Of a lion's hide. If I am drowned in blood, what a pleasant death! The wish of ferocious courage. The pride or prudence of the Orsini restrained them from the field, which was occupied by three of their hereditary rivals, whose inscriptions denoted the lofty greatness of the Colonna name. Though sad, I am strong. Strong as I am great. If I fall, addressing himself to the spectators, you fall with me. Intimating, says the contemporary writer, that while the other families were the subjects of the Vatican, they alone were the supporters of the capital. The combats of the amphitheatre were dangerous and bloody. Every champion successively encountered a wild bull, and the victory may be ascribed to the quadrupeds, since no more than 11 were left on the field, with the loss of 9 wounded and 18 killed on the side of their adversaries. Some of the noblest families might mourn, but the pomp of the funerals in the churches of St. John Lateran and Santa Maria Maggiore afforded a second holiday to the people. Doubtless it was not in such conflicts that the blood of the Romans should have been shed, yet in blaming their rashness we are compelled to applaud their gallantry, and the noble volunteers, who display their magnificence and risk their lives under the balconies of the fair, excite a more generous sympathy than the thousands of captives and malefactors who were reluctantly dragged to the scene of slaughter. This use of the amphitheatre was a rare, perhaps a singular, festival. The demand for the materials was a daily and continual want, which the citizens could gratify without restraint or remorse. In the 14th century, a scandalous act of concord secured to both factions the privilege of extricating stones from the free and common quarry of the Colosseum. And Pergius laments that the greater part of these stones had been burnt to lime by the folly of the Romans. To check this abuse and to prevent the nocturnal crimes that might be perpetrated in the vast and gloomy recess, Eugenius IV surrounded it with a wall, and by a charter, long extant, granted both the ground and edifice to the monks of an adjacent convent. After his death, the wall was overthrown in a tumult of the people, and had they themselves respected the noblest monument of their fathers, they might have justified the resolve that it should never be degraded to private property. The inside was damaged, but in the middle of the 16th century, an era of taste and learning, the exterior circumference of 1,612 feet was still entire and inviolate. A triple elevation of 80 arches, which rose to the height of 108 feet. Of the present ruin, the nephews of Paul III are the guilty agents, and every traveller who views the Farnese Palace may curse the sacrilege and luxury of these upstart princes. A similar reproach is applied to the Barberini, and the repetition of injury might be dreaded from every reign, till the Colosseum was placed under the safeguard of religion by the most liberal of the pontiffs, Benedict XIV, who consecrated a spot which persecution and fable had stained with the blood of so many Christian martyrs. When Petrarch first gratified his eyes with a view of those monuments whose scattered fragments so far surpassed the most eloquent descriptions, he was astonished at the supine indifference of the Romans themselves. He was humbled rather than elated by the discovery that, except his friend Rienzi and one of the Colonna, a stranger of the Rhone was more conversant with these antiquities than the nobles and natives of the metropolis. The ignorance and credulity of the Romans are elaborately displayed in the old survey of the city which was composed about the beginning of the 13th century. And without dwelling on the manifold errors of name and place, the legend of the capital may provoke a smile of contempt and indignation. The capital, says the anonymous writer, is so named as being the head of the world, where the consuls and senators formerly resided for the government of the city and the globe. The strong and lofty walls were covered with glass and gold, and crowned with a roof of the richest and most curious carving. Below the citadel stood a palace of gold for the greatest part, decorated with precious stones, and whose value might be esteemed at one-third of the world itself. The statues of all the provinces were arranged in order, each with a small bell suspended from its neck, and such was the contrivance of art magic that if the province rebelled against Rome, the statue turned round to that quarter of the heavens, the bell rang, the prophet of the capital reported the prodigy, and the Senate was admonished of the impending danger. A second example, of less importance, though of equal absurdity, may be drawn from the two marble horses, led by two naked youths, which have since been transported from the baths of Constantine to the Quirinal Hill. The groundless application of the names of Phidias and Praxiteles may perhaps be excused, but these Grecian sculptors should not have been removed above 400 years from the age of Pericles to that of Tiberius. They should not have been transformed into two philosophers or magicians, whose nakedness was the symbol of truth and knowledge, who revealed to the emperor his most secret actions, and after refusing all pecuniary recompense, solicited the honor of leaving this eternal monument of themselves. Thus awake to the power of magic, the Romans were insensible to the beauties of art. No more than 5 statues were visible to the eyes of Poggius, and of the multitudes which chance or design had buried under the ruins, the resurrection was fortunately delayed till a safer and more enlightened age. The Nile, which now adorns the Vatican, had been explored by some laborers in digging a vineyard near the temple or convent of the Minerva, but the impatient proprietor, who was tormented by some visits of curiosity, restored the unprofitable marble to its former grave. The discovery of a statue of Pompey, 10 feet in length, was the occasion of a lawsuit. It had been found under a partition wall. The equitable judge had pronounced that the head should be separated from the body to satisfy the claims of the contiguous owners, and the sentence would have been executed if the intercession of a cardinal and the liberality of a pope had not rescued the Roman hero from the hands of his barbarous countrymen. But the clouds of barbarism were gradually dispelled, and the peaceful authority of Martin V and his successors restored the ornaments of the city as well as the order of the ecclesiastical state. The improvements of Rome since the 15th century have not been the spontaneous produce of freedom and industry. The first and most natural root of a great city is the labor and populousness of the adjacent country, which supplies the materials of subsistence, of manufactures, and of foreign trade. But the greater part of the Campagna of Rome is reduced to a dreary and desolate wilderness. The overgrown estates of the princes and the clergy are cultivated by the lazy hands of indigent and hopeless vassals, and the scanty harvests are confined or exported for the benefit of a monopoly. A second and more artificial cause of the growth of a metropolis is the residence of a monarch, the expense of a luxurious court, and the tributes of dependent provinces. Those provinces and tributes have been lost in the fall of the empire, and if some streams of the silver of Peru and the gold of Brazil have been attracted by the Vatican, the revenues of the cardinals, the fees of office, the oblations of pilgrims and clients, and the remnant of ecclesiastical taxes afford a poor and precarious supply, which maintains, however, the idleness of the court and city. The population of Rome, far below the measure of the great capitals of Europe, does not exceed 170,000 inhabitants, and within the spacious enclosure of the walls, the largest portion of the 7 hills is overspread with vineyards and ruins. The beauty and splendor of the modern city may be ascribed to the abuses of the government, to the influence of superstition. Each reign, the exceptions are rare, has been marked by the rapid elevation of a new family, enriched by the childless pontiff at the expense of the church and country. The palaces of these fortunate nephews are the most costly monuments of elegance and servitude. The perfect arts of architecture, painting, and sculpture have been prostituted in their service, and their galleries and gardens are decorated with the most precious works of antiquity which taste or vanity has prompted them to collect. The ecclesiastical revenues were more decently employed by the popes themselves in the pomp of the Catholic worship. But it is superfluous to enumerate their pious foundations of altars, chapels, and churches, since these lesser stars are eclipsed by the sun of the Vatican, by the dome of St. Peter, the most glorious structure that ever has been applied to the use of religion. The fame of Julius II, Leo X, and Sixtus V is accompanied by the superior merit of Bramante and Fontana, of Raphael and Michelangelo, and the same munificence which had been displayed in palaces and temples was directed with equal zeal to revive and emulate the labors of antiquity. Prostrate obelisks were raised from the ground and erected in the most conspicuous places. Of the 11 aqueducts of the Caesars and consuls, 3 were restored. The artificial rivers were conducted over a long series of old or of new arches to discharge into marble basins a flood of salubrious and refreshing waters. And the spectator, impatient to ascend the steps of St. Peter's, is detained by a column of Egyptian granite, which rises between 2 lofty and perpetual fountains to the height of 120 feet. The map, the description, the monuments of ancient Rome have been elucidated by the diligence of the antiquarian and the student. And the footsteps of heroes, the relics not of superstition but of empire, are devoutly visited by a new race of pilgrims from the remote and once savage countries of the north. Of these pilgrims and of every reader, the attention will be excited by a history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The greatest, perhaps, and most awful scene in the history of mankind. The various causes and progressive effects are connected with many of the events most interesting in human annals. The artful policy of the Caesars, who long maintained the name and image of a free republic, the disorders of military despotism, the rise, establishment, and sects of Christianity, the foundation of Constantinople, the division of the monarchy, the invasion and settlements of the barbarians of Germany and Scythia, the institutions of the civil law, the character and religion of Muhammad, the temporal sovereignty of the popes, the restoration and decay of the Western Empire of Charlemagne, the crusades of the Latins in the East, the conquests of the Saracens and Turks, the ruin of the Greek Empire, the state and revolutions of Rome in the Middle Age. The historian may applaud the importance and variety of his subject, but while he is conscious of his own imperfections, he must often accuse the deficiency of his materials. It was among the ruins of the Capitol that I first conceived the idea of a work which has amused and exercised near 20 years of my life, and which, however inadequate to my own wishes, I finally deliver to the curiosity and candor of the public. Lausanne, June the 27th, 1787.
Listening to this audio connoisseur production. We are dedicated to bringing the world's finest literature to an audience of discriminating listeners. If you would like to place an order, would like information about our fine products, or if you have questions and comments, please visit our website at www.audioconnoisseur.com. At this website, you may listen to samples from all of our productions. You may send email to information@audioconnoisseur.com or call us toll-free at 866-388-8899. And thank you again. We value every single listener. This production was narrated by Charlton Griffin.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.